The Lord be with you. Jesus said to the disciples, "It is not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but it is what comes out of the mouth that defiles." And so we remember that it's not what comes into our life that defines us. It's what we send out from our life that defines us. Last week, we heard the story about Joseph. We heard how his brothers were jealous when he prophesied that they would one day all bow down before him. And so in their jealousy, they beat up Joseph. They stripped him of his cloak. They threw him in a pit, left him to die, and he was sold into slavery in Egypt. Now, this is a bad thing, right? But Joseph knows that even though he's experiencing this bad thing, this is not the end of the story that God has for him. And he knows that while he can't control what comes into his life, he can control what he sends out from his life. And so when slavery comes into Joseph's life, what he sends out is diligence. Because slavery in the ancient world was very different from slavery in the United States. Here in the United States, slavery was a lifelong bondage. There was an assumption that people deserved to be slaves because of the color of their skin, and so people were forced into that role forever. But in the ancient world, slaves were whoever got captured or whoever couldn't afford to pay their bills otherwise. And slaves of powerful people could rise to prominence. And it just so happens that Joseph was sold as a slave to the captain of Pharaoh's guard, a man named Potiphar, a powerful man with great wealth. And so, even though slavery came into Joseph's life, Joseph put out diligence and hard work. And Potiphar saw this. And so he promoted Joseph to be in charge of all the wealth that Potiphar had. And this was definitely a good thing for Joseph. Suddenly he had riches and luxury. And Joseph still knew, though, that this wasn't the end of God's story for him. And while he couldn't control what came into his life, he could control what he sent out of it. And so when comfort and privilege came into his life, Joseph continued to send out integrity. Potiphar's wife one day came to Joseph and said, "Hey, you're a good-looking young man. Why don't we have a roll in the hay together?" And Joseph said, "Whoa, wait a minute. Your husband has given me everything that I have. I would never betray him in this way." And the woman said, "Ah, but you know you want to." And Joseph said, "No, I really don't." Now, Potiphar's wife was not a woman who was used to hearing the word no. So she grabbed hold of Joseph's cloak and said, "No, you're going to lie with me." To which Joseph did the only thing he could and just got out of the room. But it meant he had to leave behind his cloak in her hand. And so Potiphar's wife went to all the household and said, "What? Look at this. My husband had the decency to let a Hebrew man live in our house, to put him in charge of things. And how does he repay us? By trying to sexually assault me. I have his cloak as proof." Which is an important reminder that sexual abuse is not about gender. It's about power. Potiphar's wife had power over Joseph, and she used it to either get what she want or to punish him for him not giving it to her. So Potiphar believed his wife, and Joseph was thrown in jail, which is definitely a bad thing. But Joseph knew that wasn't the end of God's story for him. And he knew that while he couldn't control what came into his life, he could control what he sent out of it. And so when imprisonment came into his life, what Joseph sent out was compassion on his other prisoners. He cared for the other people in prison, and the jailer saw that and put him in charge of caring for everyone in jail, including two people in particular, both of whom worked for Pharaoh. Pharaoh's cupbearer, the person who literally would just hold Pharaoh's cup whenever he got thirsty, give him a drink, and also Pharaoh's personal baker. Now, these two officials had ended up in jail, and both of them had strange dreams. And they shared those dreams with Joseph. The cupbearer said, "Joseph, I had this dream in which I saw a vine and it had three grapes on it, and I squeezed the grapes into a cup, and then Pharaoh drank from the cup. What do you suppose it means?" And Joseph said, "What it means is in 3 days, Pharaoh will come and let you out of prison, and you'll get your old job back giving Pharaoh his cup. And the cupbearer said, wow, that's great news. And Joseph said, yeah, when it happens, please remember that I am here in prison unjustly and that I helped you out. Which is an important reminder that just because someone is in jail doesn't mean they're a bad person. Now, Pharaoh's baker heard Joseph interpret the cupbearer's dream and said, Joseph, I've also had a dream. I had a dream in which I had three baskets of bread on my head for Pharaoh to eat, but then birds came and they ate the bread. What do you suppose that means? And Joseph said, ooh, that one means that, yes, you also in 3 days are going to get let out of jail, but then Pharaoh's going to hang you, and the birds will come and eat your corpse, which was kind of a bummer. But both of these dreams came true. In 3 days, both men were let out of jail. The cupbearer got his old job back, and the baker got hanged. But the cupbearer forgot to keep his promise to Joseph. And he didn't say anything to Pharaoh, and years went by. Until one day, Pharaoh had a dream. And in this dream, Pharaoh saw 7 fat cows. And then behind them, he saw 7 skinny cows. And the 7 skinny cows came and they ate the fat cows. And Pharaoh woke up really weirded out by this dream. And he's like, anyone know what it means? And everyone's like, oh. And the next night, he had another dream. And in this dream, he saw 7 full ears of corn. And behind them, 7 withered ears of corn. And the 7 withered ears of corn came and ate the 7 full ears of corn. And Pharaoh once again said, whoa, what's with these dreams? Can anyone explain what they mean? At which point the cupbearer said, ooh, I did a bad thing. I forgot to tell you about this guy named Joseph who's totally in prison unjustly, but he's really good at interpreting dreams. I bet he could help you out. So Pharaoh got Joseph and asked him what the dreams meant. And Joseph explained both dreams meant the same thing. That Egypt was going to have 7 good years of harvest, followed by 7 years of famine. And those 7 years of famine would eat up all the food that had been gathered in those 7 good years. And so Joseph said to Pharaoh, look, God has given you a blessing by warning you ahead of time. So here's what you should do. You should appoint someone to gather up all the extra grain in Egypt in those 7 good years, so that in the 7 bad years, you can distribute it and feed people so that folks don't starve during the famine. Pharaoh said, that's a great idea. Joseph, I'm putting you in charge. I'm giving you all authority in Egypt. You can do whatever you want. You're second in command only to me. Now, this is a really good thing for Joseph. But Joseph knows that God's story is not over for him yet. And he knows that while he can't control what comes into his life, he can control what goes out. So he can control that Pharaoh gave him this great power, but he could control what he did with it. And so what he put out into the world was service. Sure enough, he went and he gathered up all the grain that he could and put it in granaries to make sure that when the famine came, people would have food. And sure enough, 7 years later, after 7 good years, a famine hit. And Joseph was prepared, and he started selling that grain to people who needed it. And 2 years in, 10 men showed up to ask Joseph for grain. 10 men who came from the land of Canaan, and who said that they were brothers, sons of a man named Israel. These were Joseph's brothers who had come looking for food. And they had heard there was a certain man who could give it to them. But they didn't realize that man was Joseph. You better believe that Joseph realized that those were his brothers, though. And in this moment, what had come into his life was an opportunity for vengeance. And while he couldn't control what came into his life, he could control what he put out. And so while an opportunity for vengeance came into his life, what Joseph decided to put out was vengeance. He's like, oh, vengeance is sweet and it's best served cold. I'm going to teach these jerks a lesson. How do they like it when they get stuck in a pit that they can't get out of? So Joseph said to them, oh, really? You just happen to be a family of 10 people coming looking for grain, huh? Well, I think you're spies. And they're like, well, we're definitely not spies. We're just brothers looking for food, trying to feed our families. Joseph's like, nope, you're spies, and I'm going to throw you all in jail. And they're like, no, please. We're actually 12 brothers, and we feel real bad because one of our brothers, he died a while ago, unfortunate accident. We still got one youngest brother who's, full brothers with the one who died. He's dad's favorite. Really, what can we tell you to make you believe that we're just a family looking to, feed our kids? Joseph said, you can prove to me that you're not spies by bringing your other brother back here to Egypt so I can see him for myself. But to make sure you actually come back, I'm going to keep one of you as a hostage. Simeon, get in the pit. And so the other brothers didn't have much of a choice. They left one of their brothers behind, but they did pay to get grain, and they returned to their father. Now, as they left Egypt, they looked in their sacks of grains, and they saw all the gold that they had paid for it was somehow mysteriously back in that sack. Now, secretly, Joseph had put it in there to freak them out, but they didn't know that. They thought, oh no, Pharaoh's going to be angry at us. If we ever show our face back there again, we're going to get killed. So they go back to the land of Canaan where their father Israel is. And he says, hey, I could have sworn I sent 10 sons down there. Why are there only 9? And they said, the guy in charge, he thought we were spies. He's keeping one of us as hostage. We got to take your youngest son, Benjamin, whom you love more than the rest of us, down to Egypt to prove that we're legit so we can bust our brother Simeon out. And Israel's like, I'm not going to give up Benjamin. He's my favorite son. Well, after Joseph died, he's now my favorite son because they're both sons of my favorite wife, Rachel. And I'm not going to risk him. And the other brothers are like, yeah, but then we don't have a way to get Simeon out of jail. And Israel's like, yeah, I like Benjamin better than Simeon. Don't worry about it. Which was okay until the family once again ran out of food. And Israel said, okay, better go back to Egypt and get more grain for us. And the brothers were like, no, Dad, if we go back there without Benjamin, we're all going to die. So Israel's like, okay, fine. Take Benjamin with you, but you better bring him back. Y'all lost one of my favorite sons already. Don't do it a second time. And they're like, we promise, Dad. We'll bring Benjamin back, whatever it takes. So they go back down, and they go to Joseph, who they still don't know is Joseph. And they say, look, we brought the youngest son, the one we told you about. His name's Benjamin. So nice to see you. Can you let our brother Simeon out of jail? And Joseph was like, oh, sure, let's have a party together. And then he sent him off with more grain. But this time, in addition to sneaking money in their bags, he put a silver chalice in one of the sacks of grain. And when the brothers got out of Egypt to go back and deliver the grain to their family up in Canaan, the promised land, they looked. The Pharaoh's guards came chasing after them and said, hey, one of you stole the cup of Pharaoh's second in command. And they said, no, we swear we didn't steal any cups. And they said, look, we promise we didn't steal it. If you find the cup on one of us, you can kill that person. We don't care because we didn't do it. But what do you know? When Pharaoh's guards opened the sack, Joseph had stashed it in Benjamin's sack. And so the guard said, hey, you yourself said we could kill whoever we found it the cup on, so Benjamin's going to die. And the brothers said, no, no, we promised our dad we would do anything, and we have failed. We have lost another child. In our gospel lesson today, we hear a story about another parent who's at risk of losing a child. Jesus has gone to Tyre and Sidon, north of Israel. It is a land full of Canaanites, and shockingly, there he finds a Canaanite woman. And this woman cries out to him, Lord, Son of David, my daughter is tormented by a demon. But Jesus ignores her and keeps walking on. And the woman keeps crying out after them, pestering them, persistent, as Coulter said, persistent in her desire to get Jesus' help. Until eventually the disciples say, you know, Jesus, maybe just tell her to go away. She's really bothering us. Jesus says, I've only come to tend to the lost sheep of Israel. But this woman will not give up. She literally places herself in front of Jesus so that he can't ignore her and says, Lord, have mercy on me. To which Jesus replies, It is not fitting to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. No matter how you cut it, this is a bad thing. To compare someone's dying daughter to a dog is an insult. And we are left with this question of why? Jesus, why would you do such a thing? And some scholars say, well, Jesus is just testing the woman's faith, or Jesus is showing an illustration to his disciples, or maybe it's just a joke. But if it is a joke or an illustration or a test, it is a cruel one. And I don't believe our Jesus is cruel. No, I think instead what's happening here is Jesus is helping us and his disciples understand what sin is, what it means to be human in this world. We believe that Jesus is without sin, but we believe that for him to be without sin, for that to have any meaning, Jesus must have faced and been tempted by every sin that we are faced with, every sin that we are tempted by. Jesus is both fully God and fully human, and he knows what it means to be human. And part of what it means to be human is that there are things that are put into your life that you have no control over. And some of those things that are put into our lives that we have no control over are the stereotypes and biases that we inherit about people. You see, each and every one of us has internal biases and assumptions that we go through life with. And some of them are helpful because, honestly, it's too much for us to process to treat every single person as a blank slate. And so when we look at someone, we see the kind of clothes they wear. We see the color of their skin. We hear how they talk. And we make assumptions about what we should expect from this person. And those assumptions are neither inherently good or bad. My mother is from Mexico. And she currently lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico, but she loves to speak in Spanish, her native tongue. She loves to connect with people who share her culture. And in Albuquerque, over 50% of the people there are Latino. So whenever my mom sees a dark-skinned person, she starts speaking to them in Spanish, trusting that they will have at least learned some Spanish and can talk to her back. Now, when I went to seminary in Berkeley, my mom came out to visit me. And she saw a dark-skinned person at the restaurant waiting on us, and so she started speaking to this person in Spanish. And the person looked at her with a completely blank stare, because this person was from India. And he had about the same color skin as my mom, but no other cultural connection. Right? That was a bias and an assumption that my mom had about people. It was not a malicious one. It wasn't a hateful one. It was just a pattern that she had learned throughout her life. And sometimes the patterns that we learned are based on personal experience, like for my mom and for Joseph, who from personal experience has learned to assume that his brothers are heartless jerks. But sometimes we inherit assumptions about people that we don't have firsthand experience to back up. We inherit stereotypes about people's gender or age or about their ethnicity. Jesus is no different as a human being. He would have grown up in a culture in which Canaanite people were despised, in which histories would have been told over and over about how the Canaanites had tried to wipe Hebrew people off the face of the earth, about how Canaanites were the Jewish people's enemies, how Jews should have nothing to do with them. Those things came into Jesus' life, and he had no control over that. But what Jesus has control over is what he sends out into the world. He has control over what he does in response to meeting a woman face to face who doesn't fit into those stereotypes. Because you see, it's not a sin to inherit a culture. It's a sin when we don't do anything about when that culture is wrong. My mom, when she tried talking to a couple people in Berkeley and quickly realized that there's a large South Asian community there, she stopped talking to every dark-skinned person in Spanish. Jesus, when he hears what comes out of this Canaanite woman's heart, when he sees such profound faith come from her mouth, he judges her not by what goes into her mouth, but what comes out of it. In that moment, he realizes that the assumptions that he had been given about Canaanite people were wrong, and he changes his behavior. He blesses her and praises her faith and heals her daughter. And so too, Joseph, despite the firsthand experience he had had of the cruelty and heartlessness of his brothers, when he hears something new come out of their mouth, out of their heart, he also changes. Because when Benjamin has been captured and sentenced to death, Judah, one of the brothers who threw Joseph into the pit, says, "No, please, our father cannot bear to lose another favorite son. We have already made him lose one who was innocent." And so Judah says, "Don't take Benjamin. Take me in his place. Take my life instead of his." In that moment, Joseph sees that the hearts of his brothers have changed. That over the 15 years since they beat him up and threw him into a pit, they have grown remorseful. And they have come to repent. And so Joseph judges them based on what comes out of their mouth now. He sends away all the Egyptians. He closes the door until it's just him and his brothers. And then he begins to weep. Maybe he weeps with sadness at the pain he's experienced over the past 15 years. Maybe he weeps with joy at being reunited with his brothers. Maybe he weeps in awe that his brothers have just bowed down to him, begging for mercy as he had a vision so many years ago that they would. I think all of these are true. But I think even more so, Joseph weeps because in this moment, suddenly the past 15 years of pain, of slavery and imprisonment, suddenly all that has a purpose in his sight. He says, "I am your brother, Joseph." And his brothers are terrified to realize that, because the last time they saw him, they tried to kill him. But Joseph says, "No, don't be afraid." Because you see, Joseph sees in everything that he has experienced God's hand. He says, "It was God who sent me to Egypt ahead of you, that we might preserve many life." He says, "Don't be afraid, it is not you who sent me to Egypt, it is God." Sometimes in a moment, all of our life makes sense and we see God's hand in it. Sometimes though, it takes years for us to make sense of what we have experienced. Sometimes it's not until all the chapters are put together that we can understand the purpose of the divine plot. Last week, I told you about the irrigation system I'm working on in my garden. I told you I'd give you an update this week. Sure enough, the excavation team came on Friday and dug all those trenches. We dropped in a bunch of PVC pipe. And I was grateful for it. And I racked my brain to think of a way to tie it into this sermon. And I just honestly couldn't, because sometimes it takes time to see what God is doing in our lives. Maybe a week from now, a month from now, a decade from now, I'll be able to turn it into a sermon and say it was all part of God's plan somehow. But for the moment, it's just a good day as compared to a bad day. But Joseph, in this moment, he was able to put the pieces together, to see that his pain wasn't pointless, that God brought life out of it. Now, it's important that we make meaning for ourselves and that others don't try to push that meaning for us. And it's important that when we see someone else in pain, we don't try to tell them, "Let me tell you why God is doing that in your life." Can you imagine if Joseph's brothers, having recognized Joseph before them, said, "Oh, Joseph, wow, we tried to kill you and all, but it seems like you're in charge of Egypt, worked out really great. Obviously, we shouldn't be held responsible for trying to kill you. God was at work." No, right? In that case, Joseph would have seen what's in their heart, deserved punishment. Joseph needed to make sense of that for himself. Only he could tell his brothers, "I forgive you, because God's hand was at work." Now, even though we can make sense of what's happened in our life, sometimes the way we understand what has happened will change over time. And that is true for Joseph as well. When he first sees his brothers, he says, "It is not you who sent me into Egypt, but God." But a few years later, after his father has died and he's gotten to know his brothers a little better, in Genesis chapter 50, verse 20, Joseph says, "What you intended for evil, God intended for good." Which is Joseph's way of saying, you know, actually, it was really wrong of you to beat me up, leave me to die, and have me sold into slavery. But even though you intended it for evil, God figured out a way to turn it into good. Look, life is full of ups and downs. But neither the good times nor the bad times are ever the end of God's story. And while we can't control what comes into our life, we can control what comes out of it. And this is a truth that gives us strength when times are hard, and it is a truth that keeps us humble when times are good. It seems like times are good for Joseph at the end of Genesis. He has nearly unlimited power in Egypt. He is reconciled with his brothers. He invites his whole family to come live with him in Egypt. And we could think, maybe this is the end of the story. It has a happy ending. But God's story is never finished. And maybe Joseph forgets that. Because when such goodness enters into his life, in the midst of this famine, Joseph puts out in the end suffering for so many other families. You see, when the famine hits, Jesus says, "Oh, you're starving. Well, I can sell you some grain." And the first year, he takes all the money of everyone in Egypt so that they don't starve. And the second year, people are still starving, but they don't have any money. And Joseph says, "I'll take your livestock." And so they give Joseph all their livestock. And the third year, people are still starving, but they have neither money or livestock. And Joseph says, "I will take your land, and you can become Pharaoh's slaves with me in charge, and then I'll feed you." And so they do. And in that moment to Joseph, it might have seemed like God's providence that he should have so much power, that his whole family, all the children of Israel, should be living in Egypt where the Pharaoh has limitless control that Pharaoh has for the time being given to Joseph. But this is not the end of God's story. And next week, we begin the book of Exodus. And as we read the book of Exodus, we will see once again how out of the evil that people put into this world, God is able to bring forth good. And so may each of us remember, in the ups and downs that we have of life, in the good times and the bad, that God's story is never finished. And that while we can't control what comes into our life, may we pray for faith like that Canaanite woman, that what we send out into the world is God's goodness. Amen.